So let me begin, 1 o'clock, well, it's 1:03. We have our 1 o'clock meeting, March 9th, 2010, House Military and Veteran Affairs. First thing I want to deal with is housekeeping. If you've got a cell phone, good time to disable it. Present are Representative Tammy Wilson, Representative Jay Ramirez, Representative Bob Book, and myself, Representative Carl Gatto, the chair. Only two items we're dealing with today. First is a confirmation hearing on General Thomas Katkus, and the second one will be an overview on the Alaska State Defense Force. So let's begin confirmation hearing on General Katkus. I know who you are, but you still have to take care of this, the recording secretary, to identify yourself and then tell us why you're the best person to be confirmed for the position you are seeking.
Sir, my name is Thomas Katkus, K-A-T-K-U-S. The reason that I'm the best person for the position is a difficult question when you just lay it out there and I'm going through all my mind, okay, that just disrupted everything I was going to say. So trying to now sit there and refocus and say something positive about myself, fully qualified. I'm a federally recognized general officer. I've been a federally recognized general officer for several years. I have application for a certificate of eligibility for a two-star position, so I'm fully qualified once that gets signed by the president as a two-star major general. I've got the educational requirements. I'm a graduate of the Army War College. I have a strategic studies master's degree as a result of going through the War College. I've been in the military for close to 33 years. I'm an Alaska resident. I was born and raised here. I'm in good health and fully ready to serve.
Ex-cop.
on the civilian side, correct. Well, sir, as far as the confirmation hearing, actually, if I could, kind of the confirmation, I've gone through two of them this morning so far, and they were pretty easy, and I figured this one would be more of a practical. And I hate to, you know, just because I'm a general, try to take charge of the committee here or anything, but what better way to than to address a problem? And the problem being is I have been in charge of the Alaska National Guard here now since the governor announced my selection since about November. And we've had numerous different applications of the National Guard, of the Emergency Management, Homeland Security section, of our Veterans Affairs section, of our AMIA section. There's a small group that falls under the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, which gets really relatively little attention. They've been around for 26 years. And 26 years of service to the state, because it's a state entity, it's called the Alaska State Defense Force. And there has never been a time that I remember, in all the time that I've been in Alaska, that there's been an opportunity where a committee such as yourself has dedicated a specific time frame to hear and have the Adjutant General and Commissioner take the time to try to explain what this force is and its relevancy to today's threat environment, because it is part of Alaska's security. So, through the chair, if I may, if I can continue along that line, or if there's any questions before I start.
Yeah, we've been joined by Representative Scott Kawasaki, but General, yeah, please resume.
The Alaska State Defense Force, and I'll try to speak in broader terms rather than identifying specific statutes that cover it. I'm going to just try to direct myself towards intent. The Alaska State Defense Force was formed under the Alaska Constitution, under a statute that allows the governor to mobilize the militia, and the militia being the National Guard or its own state defense force. It doesn't make a distinction. It allows that when mobilized, that it serves as an auxiliary police force. So first of all, let me get into a couple of different descriptions that are out there. National Guard Bureau, the overall controlling entity of the National Guard, is a resourcing entity out there. It also has some of the directorates and controls and the regulations that direct how a state develops a state defense force. So even though a state defense force falls completely under the governor's command and is responsive to the state defense force is still governed by regulations, National Guard Bureau being the proponent of that. And the current regulation that governs the State Defense Force's National Guard Regulation 10-4, and it's dated 1987. So even though it's dated, it is still a current and applicable regulation.
General, while you're on this topic, in the integration of it, you mentioned the governor, you mentioned the guard, you mentioned the army. Is there a sequence of command, the top of the command being the General of the Army or the Governor of Alaska?
The Governor of Alaska. And I was going to, because that was going to be one of my first points of clarification as we move through the chain of command. But I wanted just to establish there is a regulation. It's a regulation you can find on the internet that goes directly to an authority of the Army. And that regulation has one caveat that says if the subject is not included in this regulation, it's not authorized. And that's kind of a controlling statement, that this regulation is so specific that just because the regulation doesn't cover it, a lot of people assume you can do it. And it's not. It's opposite that direction. If it's not covered specifically, it's directive in nature. You follow the reg. Chain of command. The chain of command by the governor through the adjutant general or his authorized representative. Currently in the Alaska National Guard, now I'm going through a lot of this is because what I'm trying to do, this is, again, a confirmation hearing where it's a practical. I'm going to have to describe what I've got as a challenge, as a leader, and what I need to go forward with. So I've got the State Defense Force that has morphed and is trying to develop transformation ideas just like we did with the active duty and the National Guard. Transformation being how do you make yourself relevant to the current threat environment and how do you maintain that relevancy so that you are a force multiplier in the safety, security of our nation, our state, and our citizens. So with that, the State Defense Force, controlled by the governor, usually it's the adjutant general who is the person in charge as the senior officer in the military, in the National Guard, state employee that controls the State Defense Force. An administrative order by Governor Murkowski several years ago placed that duty down to the deputy adjutant general, the deputy TAG. That person is a state employee. Now, when Lieutenant Governor Campbell was also the adjutant general before he moved on, he had directed myself as the assistant adjutant general as being the lead commander to take charge of the State Defense Force and basically organize it under their commander.
Okay, question. Is assistant the same as deputy?
The assistant adjutant general is a little different than the deputy. The statute defines the deputy TAG as the senior general officer of either service when the TAG, when the adjutant general is not present, serves as the adjutant general and also the leader of the specific service. So there's an assistant adjutant general for the Air Force, the Air Guard. There's assistant adjutant general for the Army Guard. And Alaska and Colorado have a third defining adjutant general for space and missile defense. Colorado and Alaska are the only states with three assistant adjutant generals. But they are one-star positions working for the adjutant general.
Okay. And we've been joined by Representative Lynn. Proceed.
Right now, the assistant adjutant general Army is a little bit different than in the past. Randy Banyas is the assistant adjutant general, and he's still a federal employee in a civilian job, and he's a weekend general officer, so he's not a state employee. So not being a state employee, he is not in a position where he can command the State Defense Force. So the State Defense Force is now followed, according to the administrative order, to the Deputy Adjutant General, which is Assistant Adjutant General Deborah McManus. She's in charge of the Air Guard. And it doesn't specify that the State Defense Force has a chain of command that has to be on the land forces under the Army. She is a senior state employee and well-qualified as a general officer, and she's an authorized director, commander, under the adjutant general to run the State Defense Force. So that's one of the first points of contention that I've had the various State Defense Force members approach me on, saying the chain of command, you can't fall under a federal officer. They are absolutely correct on that. The regulation, however, says the adjutant general and any National Guardsman in a Title 32 capacity is not considered a federal officer. And on top of this, General McManus is, in fact, a state employee during the weekdays, and she's the assistant adjutant general during the weekend. So that's complicated, but that's how National Guard is. It's a little bit awkward there.
And if I may ask, a state employee, and what's the title?
She is the director of the Air National Guard as a state director.
I see it. Thank you.
And her military title, though, is she's the assistant adjutant general and deputy TAG. So there's a whole bunch of different titles, and I'll try not to get confusing. So we've got the chain of command direct there. Now, in moving forward, the State Defense Force has very, very adamantly, I mean, with great compassion, they're a volunteer organization. They do things without any reimbursement costs. They're an organization throughout Alaska, and for years now have been a very relevant response force to such things as fires in Hooper Bay, they've responded to, after the 9/11 attacks, to securing the bridge across the Yukon River. They've had different applications with the start of the Iditarod and different community events. They are very prevalent in some of their communities and recognized very, very much as community participants and community members. In today's force construct, there's two ways to look at a National Guard unit and or state defense: a strategic reserve or an operational force. An operational force is first responders. Firemen is an operational force. Law enforcement, police officers, operational force. A strategic reserve is what the National Guard was prior to 9/11. Its funding level is much less. It's sitting there with a train-up period, an expected train-up period of about 45 to 60 days after a mobilization order, with a defined task before they're mobilized into federal status and then go forward with their mission. So the reason I'm defining strategic reserve and operational forces is important because I'm trying to couch the State Defense Force in that manner. In just a little bit, you'll understand where I'm going with that. So you've got the State Defense Force, which has, when it responds to fires, to floods, in direct assistance as first responders, they're really operating in an operational force capacity. The statute that provides the law enforcement component, a lot of their effort has been focused on law enforcement. Thus, you've got the initiative that they are police officers. The statute actually is a little more broad, and it says the militia, not the State Defense Force, the militia, when brought to service by the governor, under the governor's orders, it could be the National Guard, it could be the militia, can serve as an auxiliary or an additional police force. So in and of itself, you don't need an additional academy, you don't need to have a lot of specialized training. That is great. That's parallel training to what now for law enforcement officers have to be certified by the Alaska Police Standards Council. They have to have a state certified academy, and they are sworn police officers under the state of Alaska. With the State Defense Force, the presentation and police powers are not necessarily dependent on the completion of an academy, but rather the governor calling the militia to duty. That's the driving factor.
Are they sworn?
They are not sworn. It is a fact that that is part of their, they're sworn when they're part of the military because they're sworn members of the National Guard or the militia, but they are brought to duty and specifically directed by the governor in a capacity. And that capacity may include some type of law enforcement authority, such as in support of the Coast Guard, which some current plans incorporate the State Defense Force in. So what I'm trying to do is trying to move the State Defense Force to a strategic reserve level. And this answers the questions of funding, training, and resourcing. They, by regulation, serve as a cadre. And a cadre, I'm going to get up and use the board here just for a second. The State Defense Force, by reg, in uniform, should be 10 to 15% of the perceived unorganized militia in the event of a disaster. So let's take a situation like Haiti, where there is a massive disaster. I'm not talking about Haiti specifically, but a massive disaster. And you've got a band of men and women that are fully functional and able to do something to get yourself out of that disaster. This number of people is the unorganized militia down here. That's the perceived mobilized strength, and the State Defense Force should be 10 to 15%. Now, in talking with General Westall and some of the other people who have run the State Defense Force before, we've realized that anything over about 1,500 here is almost more problematic than you can train, manage, pay, keep track of, because all of these people would be brought to status by a directive of the governor to handle whatever massive disaster is going on there. So 10%, roughly 1,500, so the State Defense Force should be roughly about 150 people, that's what we're looking at, should be dispersed throughout the state of Alaska, and they serve as a cadre. Again, going by the reg there, and the cadre means they're instructors. It's these 150 people that are going to organize this 1,500 people. Now when you look at today, we've got unbelievable response capability that is developing in the United States, and it started after 9/11, and the civil support teams, each state has a civil support team, And that is the chemical, nuclear, radiological, nuclear, biological, or high-yield explosive teams in the moon suits. Those are the guys with all the high-suit equipment that help hazmat, they help the fire department, they help everyone out there in a threat environment. And again, it's a small unit. That's the initial response to some type of consequence management. It's followed by the next level that they're developing, which is the SURF-P. And that is, this is an acronym within an acronym here. So you got a Suburney Enhanced Response Package. And that gets even more complicated. What I'm trying to develop here is, right now, between the emergency management assistant compacts between states, the fact that if we had an issue in Alaska, the first thing we're going to do is be responsive to the Department of Homeland Security, emergency management, state resources. Mr. Madden, as my director of that, is going to start coordinating with other states and start coordinating resources to come in from, if we can't support it within our own. So other National Guard units, other resources, other fire departments, whatever it takes from other states to address the issue. So immediately you start having an escalation of force in response. This is before we ever get to the federal authorities. Now, because since 9/11, and this is rapidly developing, the State Defense Force was started 26 years ago, before the threat that we face now was conceived, and they had a real relevancy. But today, when you've got a strategic reserve, it's not resourced, they're not completely trained in a sense that they can be out there first responders, self-sufficient, and adequately able to address any issue. They're a strategic reserve. They need a time frame of which the mission that they are required to do is identified, and that they are tasked with that mission, brought onto orders, resourced, manned, and trained properly, and they can address their problem. And I would anticipate that to be about a six-month time frame. No matter what the magnitude of the disaster, the state should be able to start getting on its feet again in a six-month time frame. During that 6 months, you're going to have other National Guard units falling in on the state. You're going to have our own resources, and we're going to be taxing all of those entities as we try to get stood up. But in the meantime, you've got a very capable force of experienced individuals in a cadre mode that are starting to organize whatever the overall requirement of truly unorganized volunteers are, so that we can apply them to the recovery effort. So that's the strategic effort and application, trying to develop now the State Defense Force from what has been an operational, unfinanced, and unresourced force into a strategic reserve that has relevancy and that it can be applied to a problem in a very deliberate and planned method. So that requires to identify different training opportunities for them, different training tasks, primarily around what military does best. It has leadership ability, it has the ability to organize, it has the ability to get structured and bureaucratize, if that's a word, become a bureaucracy easily. And these folks in the State Defense Force certainly have that capability. So they, as the cadre, will organize the unorganized militia. That's the intent of where I'm going, as opposed to the allegations with, well, Katkus is just trying to get rid of the State Defense Force. That certainly is not the case whatsoever. You can see I've thought this out considerably there.
Yes. We have a question from Representative Book here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sir.
First of all, Adjutant General Katkus, thank you for coming before us. Thank you for serving. I'd like to put that on the record that I don't know I've had the opportunity to do that yet, but I want to acknowledge that first and foremost. I'm looking at a brochure that was put in front of us, and
5 years strategic.
On page 20, there's under strategic goal number one, it talks about unit strength. Is that the same as what you're depicting as cadre?
Yes, sir.
So here it's talking about increasing from 254 to 300 by this year, which is double what you have up there. So I'm just trying to coordinate between your testimony and this brochure.
Let me give a little bit of history. A strategic plan is just that. It's a plan, and it's adjustable. And in putting this together with the administrations, there has never been a time where we've really looked at the State Defense Force and started to really figure out how we're going to apply it and what it is. Now, I have to admit, there are certain individuals out there that are, and I have to give them thanks. Mr. Larry Woods had approached me quite some time ago when I was the Assistant Adjutant General and was concerned over how the State Defense Force was organized and how it was operating and how it was commanded. As a result of that, several investigations got started. That's what got me reading the regulations, believe it or not. So this goal of 300 was before the regulation, which it states specifically 10% to 15% in the regulation. So what I'm trying to do is move from the strategic plan and come into compliance with what the directives are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And just to notice the veteran. The 1,500 people originate from what source?
You know, those 1,500 people could be people that are now unemployed because maybe the business that they worked at no longer exists. Maybe their homes are destroyed. They might be in some type of temporary shelters, camps, depending on the magnitude of the disaster. Again, this is one of those things that you plan from the worst and hope you never get there. But if you don't at least plan for the worst, you don't want to be caught flat-footed. So it's going to be a unorganized workforce of some type. And realistically, depending on how you want to define the disaster, that would be what defines what your workforce would be drawn from.
I have to tell you, General, for me, the worst is a dirty bomb. I lose sleep over that one to think that it would happen in a city the size of Chicago, a second one in another city anywhere, and say, how do we mobilize for having radioactive waste blown around? So.
So with a lot of acronyms, it's the CST, the Suburni effort through the SURF-P, the HRF, the Homeland Response Force, and then finally into the CSMRF. Now, it sounds like a TV show, but that's about a 5,000-member active duty force that is trained specifically for those type of tasks. America is being in a posture to prepare for just those type of incidents, man-made or intentional or other natural.
Thanks, Mr. General. Tammy Wilson?
Depending upon the disaster, can that 1,500 change, or is that a maximum amount?
The 1,500 was kind of a swag as far as what did we think we could manage. And I've got a full-time workforce, and I manage a force on the Army side of nearly 1,900. And with a full-time trained force, it's almost to the point where some days you think, am I managing this, or am I just kind of getting through? So. If you have much more than that, it's almost unmanageable. So you wouldn't get it to a point where it's larger than that intentionally. So 1,500 is specifically the 10%. Now, if we had 300, and in Alaska we could really generate 3,000, then 300 would be a very good number to shoot for. But that's a lot of folks there. When you have to feed them, when you have to house them, when you have to check with their businesses or families, there's a lot to running an Army or an Air Force when you get going.
Follow up. If they're called out, is there a pay scale on that, or is it all voluntary from the very beginning? Or
the funding would come through the Disaster Relief Fund, and the pay scales that I'd be looking at is bringing them to state active duty the same as we would in any other circumstance there. State active duty pay would be what, and they'd have their coverage as far as medical. This is not free labor at this point. This is where they're compensated and actually brought to duty status. Okay.
And when we have natural disasters such as an earthquake in Haiti and the airfield is demolished, and that has to raise the price of everything, I would think.
It certainly does. You know, again, Alaska, we're really fortunate that it's large enough that a natural disaster is going to affect a portion of the state. And at some point, there'll be offsets. And we train for those also. This disaster training scenario that's going to be coming in April is an earthquake, which does anticipate take out the airfield access into a large metropolitan area. In Alaska, though, you've got offsets. You can fly to Fairbanks. You can come down another way, but your rail system might be incapacitated, your road system, and then you start using airdrops. You have workarounds. So the scenarios that are going to be driven around that are going to be very interesting, but it's something the military and the state and the active duty train for. And in April, we have a significant training event called Vigilant Guard, Alaska Shield. That is an incredible amount of opportunity training that's been in the planning stage for over a year and a half now. So we're looking forward to that type of training.
Yeah. I don't know if you expected this one, but if the natural disaster is on the Elmendorf, and that field is now disrupted because it shifted 12 feet, but that's where the planes are, now what happens?
It depends on how those are active duty planes. If our planes are coming out of Washington State and we still have access into the Anchorage International Airport, or we've got access into Wainwright or Eielson, we've got workarounds. But again, the scenarios can be driven anywhere we want. We've got a lot of people planning just those type of scenarios, and then how to access it, either through barge, through ship, through the rail lines. The concern with the State Defense Force has also been access. You know, they are seen as immediate operational force. They could be responding immediately. When you step back and look at our National Guard, though, in today's terms, when there's a Soviet incursion on aircraft flying towards Alaska, mm-hmm. General Atkins launches his F-22s to do the intercept. The feed that provides the sensors and the information to notify him of those incoming Soviet threats is National Guard, the Air Combat Control Squadron, active National Guardsmen that work right in General Atkins' building. So the F-22s are basically vectored and directed by the control command node, the Alaska National Guard. The tankers that go to refuel the F-22 that's en route for the intercept is the 168th Wing, the Air National Guard, out of Eielson. So they launch to refuel those aircraft. If one of those aircraft is damaged and falls to the ground and there is a medical assist required, it's the pararescue from the Air National Guard that respond. And it's the Rescue Coordination Center who directs all of that rescue effort, again, the Air National Guard. So the National Guard plays a critical component 24/7 in Alaska. Missile defense, 24/7 in Alaska. The National Guard is doing things that it's never done before. It's incredible how involved we are and engaged with our active duty brethren and our day-to-day security response to the security of Alaska and the nation. An example that if you take this same scenario and you put it in Delaware or Rhode Island or Maryland, this past weekend there was a heart attack about 50 miles in a remote cabin west of Clear Air Force Base. They called the troopers. The troopers said, we don't have the assets to get out there right now. Could we get the RCC, the Rescue Coordination Center, Air National Guard, to coordinate a rescue? RCC notified the 176 Air Wing, the pararescue folks, and they headed off with a 130 and a PAVHOC. Pararescue people on both aircraft, and it's always redundant. They always have a backup plan. So the PAVHOC is en route at Talkeetna. It gets weathered out. It cannot get through the weather system to get to this person having a heart attack 50 miles west of Clear. The C-130 continues over. They confirm with the doctor that this is critical. It needs to be done. Pararescue personnel on the C-130 jump out in the dark of the early morning, land in snow, call in two additional airdrops to get their medical supplies in, and administer first aid to the heart patient. In the meantime, the RCC has coordinated a response from General Troy, Major General Troy, active duty out of Wainwright with a Black Hawk. So active duty Army flew a mission on a weekend to call up a crew in the middle of their time off, dispatch it, pick up the pararescue men and the patient, and get them all in the hospital in Fairbanks by 11:30 in the morning. Pretty phenomenal response. That's rescue in Alaska. That's National Guard. That's active duty working together. The State Defense Force is not going to be that robust, but the State Defense Force still has a play in this game. They are still a part of the security of Alaska, and they play a valuable part. They bring to the table an institutional knowledge, a skill set, and above all, a dedication and passion. The men and women of the State Defense Force, if you've ever met one, are passionate individuals that really believe in selfless service. They work for free. They are out there and will do any task that you ask them to do, and they'll do it with zealousness and drive. They're an incredible group of people. So it's imperative that we look for a way to make sure that they are relevant and how they fit into the picture. And again, as a strategic force out there, a strategic reserve, it's not sexy and it's not right up front, but it's a critically important task, and we will be prepared for it. So with that, that's pretty much my presentation on the State Defense Force. If there's any questions on, if there's any concern about its relevancy, my concern for making it relevant and bringing it to into the fight.
Just a comment that handling a civilian having a heart attack sounds like one heck of a training mission for other events that are going to be exactly that, except it's not a heart attack, it's a downed Air Force plane or...
Those PJs, we should all, as Alaskans, be exceptionally proud of those, because that is their wartime mission. If a pilot goes down in the middle of nowhere, it doesn't matter whether it's in the middle of an ice field, in the middle of the water, those PJs will jump on it. They will insert with helicopters. They will fight their way into it. But a heart attack in the middle of Alaska, what a better training scenario, real life, with the pressures of life and death, can you get other than in this great state?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the privilege. General, man, sir, I look forward to voting for your confirmation in the spring. I think you are just a great asset, and you have been since we've met during my tenure in the legislature. I think a world of you and your civilian counterparts, who I also know and have tremendous respect for, as well as your predecessor. And he left big boots to fill, and with all due respect, I think you're doing a fine job of filling them, sir, and I admire you for your dedication and your working man's approach to putting your own thumbprint on the job. I'm very, very deeply appreciative. With regard to the Alaska State Defense Force, I want to thank you for bringing this into focus and freshening it. Sir and Mr. Chairman, in our lives and in our private sector vocations, we all have different missions. You know, we may keep the living room and the master bedroom and the second bedroom clean, but lo and behold, the den or the basement kind of gets away from us. And occasionally, it's nice to detail, you know, parts of the residence that you just haven't been through. So I applaud you for detailing for the benefit of the Military and Veteran Affairs Committee. The Alaska State Defense Force. I think it's empowering to kind of brush us up on this part of the mission, and I applaud you for that. I'm just speaking for myself. I went to a gun show in Fairbanks, and I had some Alaska State Defense Force officers and enlisted men who love their country. They love their state. They love being part of the Alaska State Defense Force, but they have felt that their mission wasn't as detailed as it could be, and I am delighted for you to come put some sunshine on what they're doing, and for you to have cleared some of the cobwebs on that, and A-plus to them for bringing the concern forward, and A-plus back at you, sir, for addressing the needs of the ASDF and for detailing that to the chairman and the rest of us on the Military and Veteran Affairs Committee, and I very much appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Does that conclude the summary of the Defense Force?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and we did not intend to accept public testimony on this. This was just an overview. With that in mind, I'd like to bring it back to the confirmation hearing. And so I can ask, is there anyone in the audience that has questions on the confirmation hearing? And if not, is there anyone? And by the way, Mr. McHugh, did you plan on testifying?
No, sir, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And is there anyone online that may wish to testify?
Thank you, Chairman. This is Judy at the Matsu LIO, and we have someone here.
Okay, let's have that person identify himself.
My name is Larry Wood.
Okay, Mr. Wood, go ahead. We have just a few minutes that we've allotted to the testimony, so go ahead and we'll squeeze it in.
Okay, I sent you folks some documents. I think there's an issue with open and transparency within DMVA. Try getting a report out of DMVA. It doesn't happen, particularly when the reports concern you. The reports I'm concerned about have been at the Department of Law for over 100 days. And as the email from Mr. Knave indicates from DOL, I'm probably not going to get anything. However, I would like to comment on the remarks that General Katkus made, the idea of a strategic reserve is specious at best, and it places the State Defense Force in a position of impotence, if you will, with little ability to assist the citizens of the state of Alaska. I'm someone who was called up twice on state active duty in 2006 for the Houston flood and the Valdez flood. Our duty at the time was to keep the police, the Valdez Police Department and the Alaska State Troopers of the Glen Allen Detachment, serving their communities. We set at the checkpoints. We also reduce the manpower requirements for DOT to serve at those checkpoints. It was estimated that we saved DOT about $100,000. Now, according to General Katkus, somehow or another, this organization is going into a cadre status, and golly gee whiz, you're going to wait 6 months for something to come online that appeared there the next day after it was requested. Two, what General Katkus is failing to state about the forces that he bragged about, and thank you, Lord, that they're here, because I'm familiar with the 10th Aerospace, I'm familiar with RCC, I'm former Civil Air Patrol as well. Those forces are full-time. What he didn't tell you was the call-up time for the 207th, the 297th, the regular ground forces. ASDF, when called up in association with their National Guard peers, if you will, their federal peers, is generally on-site within 12 to 24 hours. The National Guard takes longer. What is also not stated is on state active duty, when you use federal assets, according to NGR 500-1, the state pays the price. You pay for the weapon, you pay for the clothing on that man's back, you pay his wages. State Defense Force members get $175 a day. They supply their own equipment, their own gear. They come trained and ready.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Wood. Is all your testimony in electronic format, and has it been shared with the members of the committee?
It's not in electronic format. Documents have been shared with the committee. Because one comment I wanted to make, General Kafka said that he had taken a great deal of time in studying the Alaska State Defense Force. I met with him in November of 2007. At that time, he expressed to me in the 25 years he spent with the National Guard at that time, he had never worked with the Alaska State Defense Force and knew absolutely nothing about it. And he was the Joint Forces Commander of the Alaska Army National Guard at the time.
So, Mr. Wood, I have a, looks like an email that you sent to me with copies to every member of the committee. Is that the document that you are talking about right now?
There are documents there that are relevant, yes. Probably the 1 February 2008 letter applies there because General Katkus was tasked with investigating a complaint I made to the governor. And that tasking shows the depth he went into it. If you take that letter and compare it with the 22 July letter on the part of then Lieutenant General Craig Campbell, I think you'll find that my complaint to the governor was vindicated. The Alaska State Defense Force was lacking in many areas.
Okay, Mr. Wood, we have in the audience here Mike Coons, who I'm sure you're familiar with, and I'm going to ask Mr. Coons to come forward to the podium and use the microphone and conceivably maybe give us an alternative side to some of the comments you've made or support your comments depending on what his views are. So, Mr. Coons, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, sir. I'm Major Michael Coons. I'm the Executive Officer for the 1st Battalion Central Command 49th Readiness Brigade, Alaska State Defense Force. I've been with Alaska State Defense Force for 9 years. And I appreciate this opportunity. When people see the government, they think overspending, no bang for the buck. I got this is kind of a prepared speech, and I'm not really relating to Mr. Wood on this. This is something I've been wanting to say. However, the State Defense Force has given a product, public safety, for a very small price, far less than any other agency could. How is this possible? First off, we volunteer without pay to join. Then we train one weekend per month without pay. All equipment, uniforms, backpacks, firearms, ammo, sleeping bags, all those items needed to deploy on a moment's notice, we have paid for. The only cost that the state has is when we are deployed to protect our state. Since I've been in, we've had deployments to the Yukon River Bridge immediately after 9/11. Then Winter Town in 2003. Then Hooper Bay, Willow Flood, and Valdez Flood in 2008. Cost? Mr. Wood's incorrect. $250 to $280 a day per person. That's what I got paid when I was deployed. And since 2008, we have not been deployed. So what do we do between call-ups? Train. How much does that cost the people of the state? Zero. What is the cost of the average soldier of the last State Defense Forces volunteers? Average $4,000 per person. Brigadier General Kakis has revised our mission. Where we were the lead on small disasters, the National Guard now will take that role for both small and large. We are now the strategic reserve. After being briefed by him, I understand this concept. His emphasis is that a cadre mission, in the event of a major disaster, we train the unorganized militia and then respond to a disaster for whatever task which will rebuild the community, affected communities. I've expressed to him my concern about the time frame it takes for the National Guard to respond, and General Kakis assures me that the National Guard can be boots on the ground in hours. Under existing law, the National Guard can call up people rapidly upon a need by the governor. However, the equipment that is to go with the people, the transportation aspects, weapons, communications, etc., is equipment bought by the federal government and that the National Guard Bureau and the President has to approve the use of. This is the thing that slows down response. The question then is, how can we, the militia, that being the National Guard and the State Defense Force, respond rapidly, effectively, both cost and goal, to the needs of the affected communities both during small and large disasters or terrorist attacks? Also, who is the most cost effective for the small disasters? There is an increasing distrust of there. Since the National Guard's budget is more federal than state, i.e. $1 of state funds for every $3 of federal, the perception by the average citizen is that the National Guard is more federal than state government than state. We are responsible, the State Defense Force, to the state of Alaska. Not only have we been used to mitigate small disasters as a lead element, but we have done the civic events as well. We have been used at the Iditarod restart many times. Have helped at Seward's Day in Seward, all cost savings to the events. Because of these events, the people see us as neighbors and friends. The public doesn't see the National Guard a lot of times until situations like the LA riots or Katrina, along with the negative quote-unquote stories that come out. What would help reduce the negative perceptions would be for the National Guard and the State Defense Force to be available for those civic missions. Let the public know that we all are neighbors and are there for the people of Alaska and not a threat to their civil liberties. The State Defense Force budget cannot be found in DMVA's budget request, this per Karen Sawyer and others, yet somehow we get $35,000 for all operations a year. That does nothing for recruitment, training equipment, replenishing ammunition, and nothing to maintain a person at the ASDF headquarters to do administrative duties and guide those who want to join into the unit. The DMVA is overall in charge of all three organized militias, the National Guard, the Naval Militia, and the State Defense Force. Why can't funding requests be channeled up to the director, compiled, sent to you, approved, and back to the respective organizations? With what we have done and will continue doing for this state and her people, a budget increase that would pay for the above needs would be money well spent. The ASDF has and can and will continue to give the people of Alaska a huge bang for the buck with the proper support by you, the legislature, the TAG, and the governor. I thank you for the opportunity to speak candidly, and I fully support General Kakis as the new Adjutant General and Director of Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
Well, I appreciate your testimony, Major. Is there anyone else that wants to testify? General Kakis, back before the microphone.
Sir.
I think we've probably reached the end of our testimony. Unless we have some questions from the committee, we'll entertain a motion to move his forward. Representative Miller.
I move that the House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, after a review of the qualifications of the governor's appointee, General Thomas Kakis, recommends that his name be forwarded to the joint session of the Alaska Legislature with complete confidence in his abilities to serve our state.
Any objections? Seeing and hearing none, We will move the recommendation forward, and this committee is now adjourned.
Sure, I'd like to.